I would really, really, really want my children to have a happy life. I would want them to live happily, without being displaced, without being killed, or even getting tortured.
Now, do you think the current war in Sudan is actually a continuation of the long-term plan by imperialists to balkanize this country?
I don't necessarily know about a long-term plan, but what I do know is that some people certainly do benefit from chaos on the African continent. As I mentioned earlier, it helps keep the prices of primary resources that feed the global industrial economy low. It helps keep those materials cheap, which benefits the local economy. If these African countries such as Sudan and South Sudan are able to maintain some form of political stability, they're able to build economies and build wealth, there will no longer be any need for them to export their raw materials cheaply, which is what Africa has been doing for hundreds of years. So which obviously will be to the detriment of our wealthier neighbors, you know, to the north. So it's not beyond the realms of possibility that there certainly is such a scheme.
Well, as the conflict between the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces continues across the country, more people are being displaced and humanitarian needs are increasing daily. Now, tell us more about the current humanitarian situation in Sudan.
The multilateral charities involved, as far as I can tell, are making a valiant effort to try to actually, you know, get this aid to the people that need it. But a lot of it simply isn't getting there. And there's also a funding shortfall. You know, I forget who it was that I saw making a comment about this a few days ago, but this is someone who works within that space. I think he works in partnership with the World Food Program, and he was mentioning that the amount of financial aid which has been made available to Ukraine versus the amount of financial aid which has been made available to Sudan, that it's disgraceful because the humanitarian crisis in Ukraine is a fraction of the humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Now, over the recent years, we have been hearing a lot about African solutions to African problems. Now, this initiative aims to ensure that the continent is not exploited anymore by global imperialist powers. However, in the case of Sudan, the African Union seems to have failed to rise to the occasion. Now, why has the African Union failed to play a leading role in solving the ongoing conflict in Sudan?
Well, so that's actually a very simple question. That's probably the simplest question you've asked me today. And the simple answer to that question is because the African Union does not fund itself. Fully, 74%, so 84% of the African Union's budget, annual budget, is funded from outside of AU member states. AU member states collectively fund only 16% of the AU's annual budget. And of that 16%, which they have to fund, the effective collection rate of that 16% is only 88% of that 16%. So there's, even of that 16% of the total AU's budget, there's still 12% of that 16% which goes unfunded annually, at least as at last year. So basically, the people who set the agenda for the AU are the people who fund it. And the biggest single source of funding to the AU happens to be the EU. So unfortunately, the AU does not work in the interests of the African continent because the AU is not funded by Africa. The AU does not represent the interests of Africa. The AU represents the interests of the people who fund it.
Now, analysts say that the Sudanese conflict has reopened old wounds between and among communities. There is little or no chance that warring parties will sign a permanent ceasefire in Sudan in the near future. Now, our last question, do you think we are going to witness a more intense phase of the war?
Yes. Something near miraculous doesn't happen, that looks like it will almost certainly be the case. It seems to me that whoever is responsible for funneling, you know, increasing amounts of these arms and ammunition into Sudan, clearly is really motivated to do it because the conflict does not seem to be slowing down anytime soon. So just based off of the fact that these supplies, wherever they're coming from, who knows, but these supplies are not slowing down. There is little incentive for either of these sides to look for a peaceful solution, to find a solution to create some sort of ceasefire and, you know, start building some sort of stability so that Sudan can start rebuilding itself. It doesn't look like that's going to be the case anytime soon, simply because, again, the funneling of arms and funding for these groups is not slowing up anytime soon. And this cuts across the... So this includes actors from Europe. This includes actors from Asia. This includes actors from the Middle East. Everyone seems to have some sort of a dog in the fight, and everyone is, you know, opposite everyone else.
Well, quite a bleak assessment of the current situation in Sudan. We shall keep you updated as the situation unfolds in this country. I'd like to thank our guest there, David Hundain, for his incisive analysis. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Goodbye for now.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Asylum seekers are going unaccounted for, or in some cases, dying, as they try to evade pushback by the Greek authorities. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Middle East Eye, the fear of pushbacks by the Greek Coast Guard is forcing many asylum seekers to flee into unknown territory to avoid being detained by the authorities when they arrive by boat on the Greek islands. Civil actors have reported a spike in disappearances and even deaths of asylum seekers since 2020, but with a limited NGO presence on the islands, many of these cases are going undocumented. In June 2022, Bashir Abdul Karim Mohammed, a Somali man, arrived by boat on the Greek island of Chios, one of about 32 people who had boarded the vessel in Turkey. As soon as they came ashore, the group quickly dispersed, fearing detection by the authorities. Mohammed with 11 others fled to the mountains. Mohammed told Middle East Eye via an interpreter, "We were up there for 5 days. When they reached a point that was too risky to cross, the women in the group refused to turn back. They said they'd rather risk their lives than go back," he said. Muhammad and three other men decided to turn back to bring them water, as they had not drunk any for days. On the way down, they were intercepted by police. He said, "We told them that there were people still stranded on the mountain." Muhammad insisted that he wanted to take the women food and drink himself, but the police assured them that they would send a rescue team, adding, "They kept repeating that they were safe in Europe." Muhammad was taken to a camp. He was then transferred to an airless container, his arms painfully bound with cables, then put on a boat and deposited on an island between Greece and Turkey. His phone was taken from him and he was left with nothing but a life vest. Muhammad later found out that the body of one of the women, 24-year-old Huda Hussein Adan, had been discovered. A coroner's report later said she had died of exhaustion due to hunger and thirst. Muhammad said, "I couldn't take this. It was too much for me. The authorities must have gone too late. They just went to collect the bodies." According to Ruhi Lauren Akhtar, CEO of Refugee Biryani and Bananas, two other women who went missing have still not been found. Akhtar said the ombudsman was contacted. Different agencies were contacted, asking for a search to happen, but that never happened. There was no accountability about what happened to this woman. Akhtar and Maddie Williamson are part of a network of volunteers that functions as an informal hotline, taking distress from people on the Greek border. Williamson began collecting pushback testimonies from undocumented people on the Turkish border in 2020 when she was working as a nurse doing casework for NGOs. Since then, she has been one of the default contacts for refugees in distress. However, Williamson's ability to help is limited. The heightened risk of criminalization has chased many NGOs and civil actors from the region. "The trick is to always convince people to call the emergency services. There is just nothing else to rescue, and rescue-wise, that can be done. No NGOs are allowed to intervene. There is not really much else that we can do," Williamson told MEE. The crackdown by the Greek authorities on NGO activities in the region has created a vacuum of accountability on the islands, with many disappearances going undocumented. In a press release on May 25th, the NGO Doctors Without Borders estimated that 940 refugees had gone missing on the island of Lesbos. According to Williamson, the figure is likely to be much higher. Williamson said, "If you tally up the number of people, even just the number of people who go missing, we truly have no idea. We've heard the stories of people being arrested and taken to prison where they are not given a translator. They're not given a lawyer. They're not given a phone. This one guy said that he was taken to a mental hospital and sedated for like a year and then just thrown back on the streets." For Tommy Olsen, a Norway-based volunteer who runs Aegean Boat Report, which monitors people movement in the Aegean Sea, between Greece and Turkey, the surge in disappearances corresponds to a heightened risk of pushbacks. Olsen told MEE, "People contact me when they have arrived. They have run from the beach and into the woods somewhere. They're basically scared to be found by the authorities because most of them who speak with have tried it many times before. They have been beaten. They have been robbed. Some of them have been raped. Of course, they have every reason to be afraid. So it's not about what they read. It's about personal experience, right?" In 2020, a prosecutor on the island of Kos charged Olsen with crimes related to alleged smuggling. Before that, he was able to collaborate with the local NGOs to coordinate rescues. Olsen said, "The NGOs told me, please don't call us anymore. We can do something with the information you provide because the Greek authorities say you are a criminal." Williamson was arrested in Chios in May 2021 following the announcement of an investigation into more than 30 NGOs and civil actors in September 2020. Williamson said, "That silenced a lot of those groups. Some of them shut down. Some people left Greece and started operating elsewhere." Williamson had all her devices removed and was strip-searched by the authorities. This marked the beginning of a drawn-out investigation that is still continuing, she said. "We are very aware that's just a form of intimidation. There is no legal basis to do it whatsoever. We're not going to stop because even if we can stop people from being pushed back, we can at least be aware of how often it's happening and how it's happening." Meanwhile, ABC News reported at least 79 migrants have drowned and hundreds more are missing and fear dead after their overloaded boat capsized and sank in open seas off Greece in one of Europe's deadliest shipping disasters in recent years. As ABC News reported, as a painstaking search for survivors continued, a European rescue support charity said it believed around 750 people were on board the 20 to 30 meter long vessel when it sank recently. The UN's migration agency estimated there were up to 400 passengers.
Iran is a country rich in culture, history, and art. The countless historical monuments scattered across the land are manifest proof of the glory of the ancient Persian civilization. And the development of modern-day Iran is evident in its major cities and metropolitan centers. But perhaps what's remained hidden from both foreign and domestic tourists are some of Iran's stunning natural treasures. I'm Daniel Arya. As the 18th largest country in the world, Iran offers a full gamut of climates and geographical attractions, from mountains and deserts to forests and caves. Iran's diverse and dramatic landscapes offer some truly awe-inspiring and unspoiled views to discover. In this week's program, we'll follow Javad Gharai, an Iranian nature explorer and documentary filmmaker, to the southern regions of Iran, where the hot sand dunes of the desert meet the turquoise and tranquil waters of the Sea of Oman. Stay with us.
Travel is the most important thing in life to me. The reason I travel so much to the unknown spots of my motherland is that I want to discover the hidden beauties of its environment and to meet its diverse ethnic groups. I believe that city dwellers, with all their knowledge, education, and modernity, must have a good relationship with the natural environment and with nature dwellers in order to live a richer, more peaceful life. A relationship like this is vital for our survival in the world we live in. It's early February. In this season, temperatures can plunge to minus 40 degrees in the towering Mount Damavand region. But I've come to a part of Iran where the temperature is as high as 20 degrees above, perfect for a good long trip in the winter. I'm Javad Gharai. I'm an Iran trotter, and this time I have traveled to the southernmost spot in my beloved country, Iran. Follow me to one of the most beautiful and pristine areas of my country, in the southern province of Sistan and Balochistan. To be exact, my destination is the southernmost area of the vast Balochistan region. In terms of culture and ethnic groups, Sistan and Balochistan province is divided into two parts: Sistan in the north and Balochistan in the south. During my many trips to the natural beauties of beloved Iran, I have come across multiple beautiful mountains and spent time traversing most of them, from freezing tall rocky mountains to forested highlands to those sitting on the hot and dry deserts of Iran. But this time, on one leg of my trip to Sistan and Balochistan province, I'm supposed to find mountains that are impossible to climb. The shape of these mountains, or should I say hills, is unique and beautiful. The locals and tourists who have visited this area have named these hills Martian Mountains. Many believe that the rocky formations in this part of Iran are very similar to those on the surface of planet Mars. Geological experts say these hills are sediments at the bottom of a sea that used to be here millions of years ago, were initially buried under millions of tons of soil following the change in the shape of the Earth's crust over the years, and were later unearthed as a result of climatic changes and monsoon rains that washed away the dirt, exposing the real face of these bizarre hills. These mountains are among the most beautiful in Iran, in my opinion. They are no less beautiful than Mount Damavand that's been registered as a national heritage. I hope the Martian mountains of Sistan and Balochistan province, of the Balochistan area in the Chabahar region to be exact, are also put on the national heritage list. The thrust of the Gulf of Oman oceanic crust under the southern area of Balochistan, in addition to wind and water erosions, are among the reasons behind the emergence of these beautiful elevations. They are made up of sedimentary rocks containing clay and lime. The beautiful furrows on their exterior have been carved out by centuries of erosion. The heights of Martian hills vary from one area to another. At their shortest, they stand at more than 5 meters tall, and at their highest, more than 100 meters. At first glance, these hills, referred to as badlands by geologists, may look like they are not very resistant, but you will change your mind once you inspect them up close, although they're not resistant enough against the rain and water of Balochistan. In the midst of these mountains is a plain where rainwater has accumulated over many years, creating a spectacular lagoon by the name of Lipar. Environmentally, Lipar, with its many and varied animal and plant species, is an important lagoon in the region. It is an important feature of the natural environment in Balochistan. The local population use water from the lagoon for their animals and in farming. I'm on my way to one of the most beautiful valleys in the Martian Mountains. I've named it the Snail Valley. If you want to know why I picked that name for it, follow me. We walk for about an hour to get to the mouth of the valley. Flatwaters set off by seasonal rains have created a beautiful and unspoiled valley and cave. This is the Nahadik Cave. It acts as the entrance to the Snail Valley. My good friend here, Shir Muhammad, was kind enough to come here from Berries to help me find this cave and walk through it to the valley. I'm sure we are in for a treat. Am I right? The valley, I mean the Snail Valley, is a very long and deep gorge that leads to the Terap Mountain. Terap is what the locals call that mountain. The reason I named this the Snail Valley is because this place is littered with shell fossils. You can see them everywhere in this mountain and in this valley. Beautiful shell fossils that have adorned this boulder and this whole area. All the exterior walls of these Martian or miniature mountains and inside the Snail Valley is covered with these shells that have turned into fossil. Another reason is that this valley looks exactly like a snail. It meanders through the mountain from beginning to end. In some places, it wraps around itself and sends you going around in circles before you can get to the other end of it. The Snail Valley is so curvy. It's one of the most beautiful gorges in the Balochistan region. And let's not forget that if a place has a local name attached to it, we should never try and put a new name on it. We must follow the tradition of the locals who have inherited that name from their forefathers, from their ancestors. So once again, we should use the same names as they do. The gorge is almost impassable in some parts, but I am so enchanted by its beauty, I've decided to move as far as humanly possible. Its many twists and turns and the millions of fossils on its walls have redoubled my resolve to move forward. We are around 10 kilometers away from the Sea of Oman. This is a very high altitude. Obviously, thousands, in other words, millions of years ago, this whole area had been under the Sea of Oman, part of what used to be the Tethys Ocean. These fossil shells date back to that time. These are millions of years old. Every time I step into valleys or Martian hills like these, I'm filled with utter joy. But I'd never take any of these back home with me or use them as ornaments. All I do is pick them up, snap photos of them, and put them back where I found them, to share all these beauties with posterity. We must protect these treasures. We are their guardians. We walk a long way and eventually arrive at a dead end. That's when we have to trace our way back. Fortunately, there are no construction operations going on anywhere close to the Martian Mountains, and that adds to the beauty and magnificence of the area. After my visit to the Martian Hills, I continue my journey to one of the most beautiful semi-traditional wharfs in Iran, the Berries Fisherman's Wharf. It is operated by the inhabitants of Berries Village, perched on top of these escarpments. Before the village was relocated to the top of the coastal cliffs, it used to be somewhere on the sand beach. Today, the locals call it Old Berries. The villagers moved from Old Berries to New Berries around 20 years ago. One of the most important reasons for their relocation was the strong winds in the area that would blow for 120 days in a row and dump sand and dust on the village. The second reason was the beautiful Berry's Wharf. The architecture used in the homes and other buildings in Baluchistan has vividly been inspired by Indian and Pakistani architectural designs. They use different, beautiful, vibrant colors in their buildings. The old mosque here is located in the area where old Berry's used to be. The rest of the village lies in ruins. They stripped the old buildings of their doors and windows and used them in their buildings in new Berry's. But they have left this mosque intact. Everything in this mosque is there, just as it has always been. That's because the Muslim population in Baluchistan have utmost respect for their mosques and sacred buildings. They never demolish them. They abandon such buildings and let nature take its course. The main occupation of the people of Berry's is fishing. The men of this land depend on the sea for their livelihood. Some strike out to the sea in small boats and throw their small nets in to catch fish. Others go out in wooden launches, which could be called the biggest of man-made contraptions. They go out to sea and spend months fishing. These large wooden motorboats are equipped with proper refrigerators and air conditioning for the crew. The fishermen here say they are not happy with their catches in recent years. They say marine life populations have shrunk drastically. The declining numbers of fish in seas and oceans has its cause in different and important reasons. The first reason behind the decrease in the numbers of marine life around the world is the boom in the human population on Earth. The growth in the human population has led to a larger demand for fish and in turn to overfishing by those in the fishing industry. Operations that are carried out via large ocean-going trawlers fitted with radars and other high-tech equipment. Ships that have nets running several kilometers and by means of radars can trap thousands of fish in every attempt in the depths of oceans. In almost every catch, these ships bring home fish weighing upwards of 300,000 kilos altogether. Industrial fishing and the overconsumption of marine life by humans leaves the fish no time to reproduce, pushing many species to the brink of extinction. In a recent survey, researchers at the University of British Columbia found that in half a century, human consumption has pushed down big fish populations by 90%, fish that are in high demand on the market. They have predicted that if serious action is not taken against overfishing by developed countries, all these species of fish will have gone extinct by 2050. Marine life populations are on the decline, which will have dire consequences for humans and the environment alike. The ecosystems of seas and oceans are intertwined with the lives of humans and the environment they live in. They're all very fragile. Iran accounts for only a small portion of the marine life caught around the world. The reasons being high prices, the small share the marine animals have of the Iranian diet, and the absence of advanced fishing vessels in the country. But European countries, the United States, Japan, and many other developed countries play an important role in the destruction of marine ecosystems. They have done more damage to the environment than any other country in the world. And this is a result of a boom in their populations, a change in consumption patterns, and the lifestyle of the people living in those countries. There are two other important reasons that have contributed to the dwindling numbers of marine animals: contamination and global warming. Berris is a very beautiful wharf. It was built at the foot of the Berris Cliffs, offering a spectacular view. Launches and boats return here with their catch of the day to sell their prized sea creatures to the middleman. Beautiful this fellow is. The local fishermen here call it the kilkita in their local dialect. It's so colorful. Unfortunately, she too is still carrying her eggs. They get caught in the fisherman's net in this season. Most of those I've seen were ready to spawn. This is their time to reproduce, but they don't get the chance to do it. They are pulled out of the water along with the thousands of eggs that they are carrying in their abdomens. Poor thing is struggling to get out of my hand. Just look how beautiful it is. So colorful. One of the fishermen gave me this lobster and said I could have it, but I'm gonna let it go because it's carrying so many eggs. After my visit to Berris Wharf, I set off on a walking journey along the shores of the Sea of Oman. Of course, I'll be walking on the cliffs all along. The view from atop the cliffs in Berris is simply matchless. Fortunately, there aren't constructions of any kind up here. The area is an asset for Balochistan and indeed for Iran because of its pristineness. I hope to see the same unspoiled beauties and pristineness the next time I visit this part of my country and its beautiful landscape. I hope more and more tourists come to visit Balochistan. Nature travelers go to places that are pristine and untouched in order to immerse themselves in the peace and quiet that those places offer. Beautiful rocky cliffs are where Berris begins. Those are the shores of Berris, among the most beautiful of our beloved country, Iran. But the bluff along the shore is crumbling into the sea. The waves lap at the walls made up of millennia-old sediments that settled on the bottom of the Sea of Oman that used to cover this whole area. The bluff is capped by a 2-meter-high layer of rock, like the one I'm sitting on right now. It feels like reinforced mortar with all the shells and algae in it, fossils that have been here for thousands, or should I say millions of years. But the layers underneath are weak and brittle, allowing the waves to chip away at them one bit at a time. The green blocks or rocks that you see on the coast are in fact the top layer of the cliff. They used to be up where I am right now. It's going to take the waves some time to turn them into sand and dissolve them in the water. It's about 60 meters down to the foot of the cliff, and as you can see, a huge slice of the cliff has splintered from the rest, or should I say from Barry's territory, and will crash into the sea one of these days. So I better cross onto the other side because it's dangerous to stand here. I really don't want to go down with it. This gaping crack here is almost 10 meters deep, but it's very likely for it to be much deeper in other parts. It's too dark for me to see. This is a very dangerous spot.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has confirmed he would turn himself in on Thursday, 24th of August, in Fulton County, Georgia, after he was indicted on charges stemming from his efforts to hold on to power after the 2020 election. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The U.S. national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump said on Monday night that he would turn himself in on Thursday, 24th of August, in Fulton County, Georgia, after he was indicted on sprawling charges stemming from his efforts to hold on to office in the wake of the 2020 election. Can you believe it? I'll be going to Atlanta, Georgia on Thursday to be arrested by a radical left district attorney, Fannie Willis, Trump wrote on his social media platform, Truth Social. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis, who launched the investigation into Donald Trump and his allies, has given the defendants until noon on Friday, 25th of August, to surrender themselves voluntarily. Fannie Willis last week hit Donald Trump and 18 other people with racketeering charges, accusing them of scheming to overturn the results of the 2020 election, and gave the defendants until Friday to surrender voluntarily at the Rice Street Jail. Three senior law enforcement officials said on Friday that they expected Donald Trump to surrender later on this week. In a news released on Monday, the Fulton County Sheriff's Office said that when he does turn himself in, there will be a hard lockdown of the area surrounding the Rice Street Jail. Donald Trump earlier on Monday agreed to a $200,000 bond under the terms of the consent bond order filed in court on Monday afternoon. 21st of August, he agreed to the bond amount on charges that include racketeering, criminal conspiracy, criminal solicitation, filing false documents and making false statements. Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee signed off on the order, which was signed by Fannie Willis and Donald Trump's attorneys. It says Trump shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. It also says the defendant shall make no direct or indirect threat to any nature of any nature against the community or to any property in the community. The above shall include, but are not limited to, posts on social media or reposts of posts made by another individual on social media. The document was filed after members of Trump's legal team, Drew Feinding, Marissa Goldberg, and Jennifer Little, were spotted entering the Fulton County courthouse around in the afternoon, walking in the direction of the district attorney's office. They declined to comment to reporters on their way in. Other defendants agreed to bond packages with prosecutors on Monday as well. As of late Monday afternoon, 21st of August, Donald Trump's was the only one that Fannie Willis had signed off on. Her deputies signed the others. His was also the only one with terms that included not making threats to the community or on social media sites. John Eastman, the lawyer charged with helping to orchestrate Trump's fake electoral scheme, agreed to a $100,000 bond on charges including racketeering, criminal conspiracy, and filing false documents. Judge McAfee signed off on the agreement on Monday morning. Under the terms of his order, John Eastman shall report to pretrial supervision every 30 days and shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her to be a co-defendant or witness in this case or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. The order also holds that Eastman shall not communicate in any way, directly or indirectly, about the facts of this case with any person known to him to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, except through his or her counsel. Conditions that Donald Trump has also agreed to. John Eastman, who is referred to but not charged as a co-conspirator in special counsel Jack Smith's federal criminal case against Trump for allegedly trying to subvert the 2020 election results, features prominently and repeatedly in the district attorney's indictment. It alleges that Eastman helped come up with and carry out a scheme to have alternate presidential electors cast their votes for Donald Trump in Georgia and several other states that Joe Biden had won. John Eastman's lawyer, Harvey Silverglade, said in a statement last week that the charges against his client and the 18 other defendants set out activity that is political but not criminal, and that Eastman should not have been charged. Another architect of the electoral scheme named as a defendant, lawyer Kenneth Chesborough, struck a similar deal, agreeing to a $100,000 bond. Ray Smith, another Trump lawyer who was allegedly involved in the fake electoral scheme, agreed to a $50,000 bond order. Judge McAfee also signed off on a bond agreement involving another defendant, Scott Hall, who is charged with racketeering and six criminal conspiracy counts relating to a scheme to access voting machines and data in rural Coffee County, Georgia. America's national broadcaster ABC News has also covered this story. A Fulton County judge has set former President Donald Trump bond at $200,000 in District Attorney Fannie Willis's election interference case. Donald Trump and the other 18 defendants in the case have been given until Friday at noon to appear at the Fulton County Jail for processing. The former president said on Monday evening on his social media platform that he intends to surrender in Georgia on Thursday, 24th of August. In addition to Trump, Fulton County Superior Court Judge Scott McAfee set bond on Monday for attorneys John Eastman and Kenneth Chesborough at $100,000 each, for Ray Smith at $50,000, and for Scott Hall at $10,000. Eastman is expected to surrender on Wednesday, according to the California judge overseeing Eastman's disbarment proceedings, who wrote in a court filing on Monday that the court is going to make certain changes in his week's trial to accommodate Dr. Eastman's surrender in Fulton County, Georgia. All the defendants' bond agreements include a provision that they shall perform no act to intimidate any person known to him or her, or to be a co-defendant or witness in this case, or to otherwise obstruct the administration of justice. Donald Trump's bond agreement says that That includes no direct or indirect threat against co-defendants or witnesses. All defendants are also prohibited from communicating about the facts of the case with co-defendants, except through counsel. An attorney for Chesborough said on his way out of the district attorney's office on Monday that the bond negotiation process was a pretty good process and that he would look forward to moving forward. It was very straightforward. We had a meeting with the district attorney's office, worked out and negotiated a deal, signed the paperwork, and honestly, it took longer to get copies than it did to negotiate, the attorney Scott Grubman said. Grubman said Chesborough would surrender for processing at the Fulton County Jail in Georgia before the Friday deadline. Asked if he was concerned about the conditions at the jail where 7 inmates had died this year, Scott Grubman said, just like any other jail, there's clearly issues in the Fulton Rice Street Jail.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86th flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. The next point is that your endeavor provided valuable experience in the field of seafaring for the Navy and the military forces. In other words, new experiences have been gained. You crossed the Pacific Ocean, and this has never been done in our maritime history. You passed through challenging straits and waterways, as mentioned in the report. Passing through some of these straits was a difficult technical task that requires skill. You accomplished this. You were able to pass through these straits and difficult routes without any unfavorable event taking place. Encountering complications on the seas in remote areas. When you were thousands of kilometers away from home, you encountered various issues that you faced and dealt with them. Another experience was your self-sufficiency in fuel, electricity, and facilities for healthcare. That is, during this adventurous voyage, you became self-sufficient in obtaining fuel, electricity, and energy and healthcare, in terms of both hygiene and treatment. You were able to perform surgical procedures. These are very valuable experiences.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
You were also able to gain new experience in communicating with your headquarters. This communication itself is a very important point. The ability to communicate. These were your experiences. These are scientific assets. These things that I have mentioned, these achievements, are all scientific assets and should be taught in universities. They can be presented as course material in naval universities and in academies that are related to the subject. The next point is that what you have accomplished has improved Iran's international image. What I want to say is that the political value of your work was no less than its military value. The fact that you were able to carry out such a large task on the sea, that you demonstrated Iran possesses this amount of power, this number of young people, this scientific capability and this vast amount of skill, which allowed it to accomplish such a great task, brought about international status for the country. The next point is that there are several lessons to be learned from this seafaring. It had significant lessons.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
For the first time in United States history, a former president now has a mugshot. Donald Trump has been arrested in Georgia and is being prosecuted under racketeering charges for allegedly trying to subvert the state's 2020 presidential election votes. 70% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still say President Joe Biden's election was not legitimate.
You should be able to challenge an election. I thought the election was a rigged election, a stolen election, and I should have every right to do that. As you know, you have many people that you've been watching over the years do the same thing, whether it's Hillary Clinton or Stacey Abrams or many others.
It's the fourth arrest for Trump in 5 months, even as Trump is running neck and neck with Biden in 2024 election polls. That has many accusing the ruling Democrats of election interference and of weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents, and of dangerously dividing the country.
Because it was dragged on for so many years, and it was really made into a theater, and Donald Trump was able to use this, ironically, to build his brand, to build this this lie that the election was stolen, and really... really just brainwashed millions of people, you know, into continuing to support him. I think it really spells disaster for the unity of the ruling class.
Trump's popularity among Republicans has soared since the first indictment, and he seems certain to be their candidate next year. Polls show the nation is almost perfectly split regarding Trump's 4 court cases and 91 felony charges. While a part of the United States has become galvanized both for and against Trump,